Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. I had the great pleasure of sitting down and interviewing Carl Verheyen. He's very well known in the studio circuit in LA and being a member of the band Supertramp. So he tells me how he got into guitar and all the studio work.
Well, I got into it, I was 11 and I had been asking for a guitar for about a year or two. And my dad had a ukulele and he played drums in high school. So yeah, at age 11, I finally got a little nylon string and I got my first lesson the same day. And it was $2.50. It was a guy in a rock band called the Peanut Butter Conspiracy. And they even had a record out. So it was a big deal. And I remember he had a piano in his bedroom. He lived at his parents' house, but he had a piano in his own bedroom. Well, it was an upright and it was jammed in there, so not that big. So then I took lessons from another guy that was James William Gershio, but I only got like two lessons from him before he went off to start that Caribou Ranch studio in Colorado that eventually recorded Supertramp and Earth, Wind & Fire and a lot of people like that. He became a big record producer guy. And then the next guy I didn't really like, and then my parents took me to a place. I'm from Pasadena. They took me to a place there on the first lesson. I'm probably 11 and a half by now or 12. My mom sat in, and the first thing I did was I showed the guy how to play Turn, Turn, Turn by the Byrds. And I'm a huge Byrds fan, and I already knew how to play Turn, Turn, Turn. And my mom immediately took me out of there. She goes, "You don't need lessons from this guy. You're teaching him." So I think that was it for a long time for the lessons. But, you know, like all of us, we're self-taught, you know, and dropping the needle on Allman Brothers records and Hendrix records and everything. And so that was it from there on. I mean, I had bands in high school, and then right after high school, I had a band. And when I was still 17, my parents took us out to a restaurant in Pasadena, and I saw this guy playing and singing in the bar. And I go, you know, I could do that. And it was a little restaurant called The Sawmill, and this guy was playing his guitar, acoustic, and singing tunes. And I go, I could do that. So I went back the next day and asked for an audition, and the guy hired me right on the spot. And I remember I played an instrumental version of Here, There, and Everywhere and Loggins and Messina song or something, you know. And he hired me right on the spot for Sundays and Mondays. But he says, "You are 18, aren't you?" And I go, "No." And he goes, "When do you turn 18? I go, "A couple months." And so he goes, "You can't work in a bar till you're 18. So come back then." So I did. And he honored it. You know, he gave me the gig. And then he eventually moved me to Tuesday through Saturday. And so I was just doing that kind of a single gig, you know. And then this guy walked in and said, "Hey, man, I like the way you play. Would you like to get together and play sometime?" He was an older guitar player, but guy, you know, an older gentleman. And I said, "Sure." And I went over to his house the next day, and he put some music in front of me and showed me a D minor 7 flat 5 chord, which pretty much blew my mind. You know, I said, "Well, if this is D minor, if I flat 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's an A. If I flat the A..." Anyway, he showed me about 25 voicings of a chord I'd never even heard of before. And we'd all heard those chords. I mean, that chord is in Penny Lane and it's in Todd Rundgren's songs. And, you know, we've been listening to it, but we didn't really know what it was as kids. So it kind of took me down a long, dark highway of jazz, which I studied really intently, and went to Berklee College of Music for one semester. And then got out of that and came back to, like, I lived down in Newport Beach area down here where there was about 4 or 5 jazz clubs. And I only did one semester because I thought what I really need to do is get on the street and start playing. I started doing that. And then pretty soon the drummer in my band, little jazz band, he got the gig with Larry Carlton. And so he moved north, you know, it's only an hour away. But he moved north up to the Hollywood area, and he started getting lots of sessions. So I pretty much followed him and slowly broke into the world of recording, you know. And that's in L.A. At the time, there was lots of TV, and there was a lot of jingles and movies and people's records. And so you start on sort of the entry level stuff, which is like sitcom stuff. And pretty soon you're getting movies. Yeah, that's kind of how it went for me. I broke into the studio scene around 1981 or so. And, you know, guitar was king. There was guitar on every little TV show and everything like that. So it was a good living for sure. Yeah, I taught myself to read when I met a guy at the union that I'd been working for. And he told me, I just want you to hear this from me. He goes, next Wednesday I have a double session for a movie or something like that. And although I like your playing better, your feel better, your tone better, your solos better, and your rhythm guitar ideas better, I had to hire this other guy because he's a better reader and we have a lot of music to get through. And that did it. You know, got frustrated. I said, that does it. I got to teach myself to read. So I actually got together with this guy. My buddy was teaching me classical guitar lessons. And I was trading him for like rock and roll guitar lessons. And I said to him, wouldn't it be great if we could take a class somewhere and learn to read better? And he said, let's start our own class. And what we ended up doing, we went down to this music store and we each bought $75 worth of music, like clarinet books, flute books, saxophone books, trumpet books. Even some bass clef books, but we got classical duets and bebop duets. And we bought like, you know, a stack of music about a foot high each. And the other two requirements were a metronome and a coffee pot. We got together at 9:30 in the morning every day for many months. But even after 3 or 4 weeks, we were starting to sight read a lot better. And it's kind of like a bicycle, you know, you learn to ride it and you never forget, you know, your feet know what to do. And so it was a question of training the eyes to keep moving, because that was the big problem with trying to read at home. I'd get to bar 14 and I go, what the heck was that? And I'd stop. But if the other guy you're reading with nails it, because he happens to be in the right position where the fingering is easy, you know, he keeps going. So you have to train your eyes to forget about bar 14 and keep rolling. I'd been to Berkeley and I sucked at reading. I was in like I transferred into Berkeley after 2 years in Pasadena City College as a junior, but my reading was like as a freshman, you know. I was already doing studio work and trying to keep up, you know, but it was a good thing to do. It was really good because then you're not bound by specialization. You know, there's guys that can't read, but they do record dates. And those are few and far between compared to the everyday stuff that's out there, you know, the TV work, the jingle work. I mean, at least in the period that I was working in, I've kind of moved on from there now, having started my own band and then being on tour right when they need you. You kind of work your way out of it, but I had no problem with that. By the time I got to where I was touring a lot, I had done plenty of sitting in a chair with headphones on, you know. Eventually, you just get confident, and you get confident enough to even tell the composer, you know, I can play what you're doing here, but to be honest with you, here's what a guitar player would do, especially one with only 5 fingers, because they'll write 7 notes in it, and you go, that can't be played, but here's what I can do.
Oh, man, I am so familiar with that. So many of the composers are keyboardists, therefore they always write impossible chords and voicings for guitar players. Carl now tells me about all his guitar influences, and he's got a huge list of people he actually digs.
Man, I got a whole lot of them. I would say the earliest guys were George Harrison and Roger McGuinn. From there, I really got into Eric Clapton. I had an idea for a masterclass called Artistic Signatures because I was going back to some of the same places every year, especially like in Italy, where I went 4 times a year for 3 years in a row. I'd be there with Supertramp or doing a guitar camp for a week and then doing a solo acoustic tour. And then the next year I did a solo clinic tour and then my band would play and I just kept going. So I made a list of people that I really, really got into as a kid and that really influenced me. And it goes like George Harrison, Roger McGuinn. And then I got into surf guitar because after school every day in LA, they had these surf shows, all that reverby Dick Dale stuff, you know. And then I got into Eric Clapton, Albert King, Freddie King, Alvin Lee, big 10 years after fan. And then I got into Leslie West, Todd Rundgren, Mike Bloomfield was a big one. And then B.B. King, Hubert Sumlin, who was playing with, you know, Howlin' Wolf, Johnny Winter. And then I got into Steve Cropper. You know, I was hearing all that Stax stuff. And when I got to be old enough to understand how heavy Jimi Hendrix was, that became him and Curtis Mayfield for that rhythm guitar stuff. Jimmy Page, of course. And then the Allman Brothers, Dickie Betts and Duane Allman. I learned some slide stuff from Elmore James and Rye Cooter. Then I got into the early Jeff Beck stuff. And then I started down that long, dark highway of jazz where I started listening to Wes Montgomery, Grant Green, Joe Pass. I even got a lesson from Joe Pass. Oh, man, he was just unbelievably good. You know, you just can't even touch that. So, and then Pat Martino was a really big influence, as was John McLaughlin. And then I started taking lessons from Joe DiOrio, who was, he had a huge impact on my childhood because he goes, when you come up with a good lick, write it down in your lick book. And so I've been doing that since like 1978, and I probably have 29 volumes of lick books here. And then George Benson, Pat Metheny, Lenny Bro, Chet Atkins, Merle Travis. And then there was this moment when I was really into jazz, and I was driving my car on Riverside Drive and Laurel Canyon, right at that corner, and I was listening to the radio, and this Eagles tune came on called Those Shoes. And I heard this Joe Walsh solo in that tune that's just super, it's just a key of E minor, right? Super passionate solo. And I went, man, the state of the art of rock guitar has come so far since I kind of checked out 5-6 years ago to learn how to play jazz. And it was like all of a sudden the skies opened up and a beam of light hit me saying, you must learn everything you dig. At that point, I started getting back into people like Bloomfield and, you know, just learning to bend notes again and be a more of a rock player and a blues player, and took a couple classical guitar, you know, started listening to Lenny Bro, Chet Atkins, Merle Travis, Joe Walsh, David Gilmour, Eric Johnson, Steve Morse, Albert Lee, who's become a really close friend of mine, as a lot of these guys have, Danny Gatton, Larry Carlton, Robin Ford, Eddie Van Halen, Andy Summers, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Alan Holdsworth, Joe Satriani, The Edge, and Derek Trucks. So all those guys I learned stuff from, you know, and assimilated into my own playing in some capacity.
Man, what an incredible list of guitarists to look up to. It would take you a lifetime to learn everyone's style and all their riffs. Now Carl tells me how he got into Supertramp and how the whole thing actually morphed into something that he did not expect.
One day I went off to do a session for a female vocalist at a place, and the engineer was an English guy. And I think this was in 1985, I believe. And he and I got along great. He liked my sounds, and I liked the way he worked. And it was some female vocalist's record. I can't even remember her name, but apparently he was in touch with Supertramp's management and their front of house guy. Those two guys talked that night, and the Supertramp people said, you know, we've been auditioning guitar players and we've heard 18 people so far and we hate them all. You know, have you heard anybody lately? And he said, I heard this guy today. I got the call to like literally 10 o'clock at night to come down at about 9:30 the next morning. I did it and just played the blues. But when I was walking in to the studio to set up, you know, whatever gear they had there, because they said, don't bring anything, I saw Buzzy Featon walking out, and I'm a big fan of his. I had done a bunch of sessions with him and learned a lot of R&B chordal licks from Buzzy. And so I go, oh, I have no chance. It worked out. I got the gig. The first two tours, I was basically a hired gun. I hadn't joined the band until like the mid-90s, and they made me a member. But the first couple tours, they had just put out this record for this tour. It was called Brother, Where You Bound, and it had a really long guitar solo on the title track by David Gilmour. And they expected me to learn it note for note, you know. I told them, you know, this is like a 5-minute solo. I tell you, I can learn it note for note. I could actually even write it out and sight read it until I know it. But I said, why don't you let me start like Gilmour does and end like Gilmour does, and let me improvise the middle it will live and breathe every night, and some nights it might be really good. You never know, you know. So the leader of the band, Rick Davies, he goes, "We'll give it a go." So they let me do it, and it came off. You know, I think I was playing an SG or something, and anyway, it came off, and they really liked it. So then they have another iconic solo on that song, "Goodbye Stranger," which starts with a wah-wah pedal. And I go, "Tell you what, why don't you let me start with that wah-wah lick? And when I get up to the top of the run, you know, let me improvise and I'll cue the ending." And they'd never done anything like this. I mean, they'd always played the solos from the records and they always rehearsed the hell out of them. And so they said, "We'll give it a go." The drummer was a little apprehensive. I said, "My cue will be really obvious. I'll look around at you. I'll raise my guitar neck. And then the next downbeat is going to be 8 bars until we're done," you know. But they didn't know from 8 bars, and they didn't, you know, but it was obvious once I started playing the ending figure. So anyway, I slowly but surely sort of morphed the gig into being something that I could improvise on. Because if I was feeling good at the end of that song, and it was the last song of the set, I'd stretch, you know. If I had a great sound in my in-ears and I walked out on the ego ramp, there's nothing better, you know, there's not a better feeling in the world. So I got that going. And then on the next album, the next album, I'm now a member of the band, the next 2 or 3 albums. And so, you know, then it was all my parts and my solos and stuff like that. So it was an interesting thing the way it worked out. There was this big, long hiatus between one tour and the next, like about 6 or 7 years. And I found out why. They were trying to get off of A&M Records. You know, A&M had kind of moved into Janet Jackson, and they were waiting to sign a new deal with EMI. And in that period, we really didn't know what was going on, but the leader of the band lived nearby me, and he was having these Wednesday night jams at his place just to try out some new material. But there was no talk of it was going to be on a Rick Davies solo album or a Supertramp record or anything like that. So we rehearsed like every other week on a Wednesday and went out to dinner and just kind of had fun for about a year. And it wasn't the whole band. It wasn't even the drummer or the sax player. They lived in different places, you know. So it was a new bass player that had been in my band. I guess I recommended him when the old bass player lived in Chicago. And so anyway, at some point, after about a year of that, they said, "We want to have a meeting with management." Okay, what's this about? And they basically went on to say that all this music you've been rehearsing is now going to be on a new Supertramp record starting, and we've got a new deal with EMI and blah, blah, blah. And so we got a signing bonus, and we were made members, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful period, you know, because now I've got a creative say in the band. But you know, I always look at this kind of thing. Supertramp is Rick Davies' musical vision. And, you know, as much as you get a say in what it's going to do and where it's going and arranging and stuff like that, you really have to stick within the confines of this sort of English progressive rock kind of, you know, musical vision, pop music thing. So it was right around 1987 87 that I started my own band, realizing that I got a bunch of music in me that needs to come out.
I hear you on that, bro. We all have a lot of creativeness that needs to get out. And I might add, it's a very hard gig to replace another guitarist, as we've seen with other interviews with Joe Satriani and Steve Morse. Now Carl tells me about his amp collection and how he used it to record new modeling for Kemper amps.
I have a lot of guitar amps. I have about 50 tube amps and about 6 more in Europe. And if it sounds good, I just don't sell it, you know. So I recently went into Sunset Studio 2, which is where Van Halen did all their stuff. I picked 27 of my amps. You know, you don't need to do both AC30s or all 4 Princetons or, you know, 200 watt Marshalls. You just need one, right? So, but anyway, I went in there and profiled them all for the Kemper. I'm totally not a modeling guy and not a profiling guy, but my producer buddy convinced me that like 1 million Kempers have been sold. So they could really use a collection like yours. And so we did that and we put it up for sale at Sweetwater, and it's already sold like a couple hundred of the Verheyen collection. I think it's like $80, $79. But we profiled each one of these amps with five different microphones. So we did it with a 57, a 121, a Telefunken M80, a Neumann 67, and an AKG 414. So we did five different profiles on 27 of these amps. And so I think it comes to like something like 147 sounds. I've been using it. I've been using it quite a bit for demos, but I got to tell you an amazing thing that just happened last week. So my record is in production, right? It's at the presses. It's being made. It's done. But I have a song called, believe it or not, it's called Garfunkel. The story behind the song is that I was 15 years old and my parents took this driving trip up to Canada with four kids in the car. We go up there. We're in Alberta, you know, it's a 2-week trip. And my parents said, "Hey kids, we want to go have a drink in the lobby of the Lake Louise Chateau, big giant hotel. You kids go out and skip some stones on the lake." And I know I was 15 because I had my learner's permit. And so the number one song of the day was Bridge Over Troubled Water. I had taught myself how to play it on piano. And so I'm just this brash young, you know, 15-year-old, and there's a white grand piano in the lobby. So I go over there and I sit down and I play the intro. I start playing Bridge Over Troubled Water. And when I got to the big E-flat downbeat of the verse, I heard this voice over my shoulder going, "When you're weary," and it was Garfunkel. It was him, the singer on the track. So he's got the number one song and he's behind me. And, you know, he was probably checking in over at the counter and went, "Hang on a second, I'll be right back. I got to go blow this kid up." And I mean, I froze. It was this massive impact on my childhood. And so all these years later, I wrote a song about that moment called Garfunkel, It Was All Too Real, you know, in parentheses. It's kind of a ballad, gospel-y kind of a ballad. And in the song, instead of the traditional big monster guitar solo, I played 15 seconds of Bridge Over Troubled Water. You know, I used those chord changes there. And I played da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da. I played all that. And when I was getting ready to, this is 2 weeks ago, I'm going, I better register my stuff with BMI because, you know, copyright all my stuff and everything for the new album. And then I went, yeah, I wonder if I need to get permission or put him on the copyright. So I called my music attorney. He goes, "Dude, I've sued people for a lot less than 15 seconds. You better get permission." So I called up Paul Simon Music, who referred me to Universal Music Publishing Group. And I submitted a big form saying, "Hey, it's 4.6% of my song. You know, do I need to give Paul Simon 4.6% of this song or whatever?" And you have to give him an MP3 and tell him at 3 minutes and 7 seconds, this is where it happens. And the lady on the other end said, she goes, "Okay, we'll review it. It's going to be $2,500 administration fee." So this was on a Wednesday. So by Friday, I'm starting to panic because my record is starting to get pressed up. So, you know, I mean, the artwork is done. Everything's on, it's at the pressing plant now. So I didn't hear from them, and I wrote them, and they go, "Yeah, we're still reviewing." Anyway, the following Wednesday, they write me an email saying, "Dear Mr. Verheyen, your request to use Bridge Over Troubled Water and as an interpolation in your song has been respectfully denied." So luckily, I'd been thinking about a plan B, and I did have the whole track on my Pro Tools rig, and so I was furious because, man, I had to halt the production, you know, just make sure they hadn't started pressing. And I got them within an hour of them going to press. I just used the Kemper. I grabbed a 335 or something and dialed up a sound, probably the same sound that I'd used on the original record, but through the Kemper. And I played a solo. And then I went, you know what? This is actually better. And then I redid some fills using that sound. And I think the whole song is better now, having done that. Because I think eventually I might have started to think that the Bridge Over Troubled Water melody was a bit hokey. You know what I mean? If I'd covered the song, it would have cost me like $128 or something like that. Had I used an interpolation, they consider it the same as a sample. They don't dig that. So You know, I probably would have flown below the radar and they never would have found me. But you never know. You never know on those kind of things. So I would not want to be sued later.
No, you wouldn't, Carl. I've seen that side of the industry, and it ain't pretty. And especially with a large company like Universal, they definitely want to get their pound of flesh. Now Carl goes on and tells me about his solo albums and how Steve Morris is actually one of his biggest influences in instrumental music.
Well, the first one was all instrumental fusion type. And then the second one, I sang a couple of songs. And I don't know. I mean, I'm a kind of guy that when I'm like the instrumental fusion stuff, I check it out and buy those records and still to this day and listen to them. But to my ears, they don't bear repeated listening. You know, I'll buy a record and check it out, see what this guy's up to and what he's doing. Then I usually sort of file it. And there are a handful of exceptions with real good players, but I'd rather listen to songs that have vocals and you know, melodic music like that than shredding. You know, so I mean, definitely by the third record, I was switching around. There'd be like two instrumentals, two or three, and the rest would be vocal tunes. The funny thing is, Brian, when I get out on the road and I sing for like 10 nights in a row, gosh, I go, man, I can actually sing. My voice opens up and it's like, it's just an instrument like anything else. You got to keep up the chops and keep that instrument exercised and worked. But, you know, when you're home, you just don't do it. And so I actually have a file on my studio computer that has the lyrics to maybe, you know, 50 songs. They're not even my songs. They're just songs I like singing, like Bob Dylan tunes and George Harrison, Paul Simon and Brian Wilson, you know, just fun tunes to sing. And so I often just get an acoustic guitar and read those lyrics and sing them. Yeah, I was really influenced by Steve Morse, his work ethic, his writing, his chops. And he and Joe Walsh and a few other people that I was listening to right at the time, they made me realize that I don't really want to be bound by specialization. You know what I mean? And I think about that oftentimes, like, you know, when you think of a guy like Stevie Ray Vaughan, how brilliant he is and was. And, you know, I couldn't really spend my life playing the blues in those three keys. You know, there's just more. And I'm not in any way putting him down because, man, I'll never be the blues player he is. Nobody will be, really. But Steve Morse kind of got me thinking, like, you know, he can play so many different styles of music really convincingly, you know, whether it's rock or fusion or progressive rock or country music or even classical guitar, you know, classical music. And he got me thinking that way early on, you know. And I think it helped me in many ways, because the studio is all about that. I mean, I remember getting this one studio call to play on a country record, and they said, just bring a Telecaster and a Princeton. And I said, okay. And I said, you know what? What if it goes another direction? Why don't you let me have my cartage delivered? So they did. In other words, a couple trunks of guitars and a handful of amps and pedals and even that rack stuff back in the day. So I show up and there's a guy there with a cowboy hat and a Telecaster and a Princeton and had the little shirt with the yokes on it. You know what I mean? The cowboy shirt. So we start playing the first tune and, you know, we both start off with Telecasters. And then I said, you know, maybe I'll complement it with a little bit of distortion on a Strat and it goes that way. And they liked that more. And pretty soon it went to straight ahead, you know, Les Paul or something. It became much more of a rock tune and showed up for the sessions the next day. And the cowboy hat guy was gone because that was his specialty. He was a country guitar player and that was what he could do. And day two, he was not needed. So I think not being bound by a specialization of one or kind or another has been helpful. In a way, as a solo artist, it's not. And this new album of mine is really all over the place. I mean, I was just, it was kind of done throughout some of the COVID period. And so I was just like, what else would I like to play, you know? And picked cover tunes, wrote a tune that feels like a David Gilmour thing, have a Jeff Beck kind of a thing on there, almost a Steely Dan type of song. And I mean, they're all under the banner of what I do, but it's, it's kind of all over the place. You can't say, well, that's a good blues album or that's a nice rock album, because it really, it's all the above. That influenced my musical career for sure, my solo career, because I remember going to a session, the composer said, and I've been practicing Chet Atkins stuff all morning, and I get there and he goes, okay, what we're going to do today, I don't want it to sound anything like a guitar. So you're going, okay, I guess that Chet stuff I've been working on is not going to be coming in handy today. I remember tuning the top two strings to a B and then tuning the next two strings to F sharp, you know, the D and the G string. And then I think the bottom two strings, octave Bs or something like that. And I made this real drony kind of a thing that I could almost play sitar type licks on. You know, it was really, really kind of fun. But what happened was when I pulled that guitar out of the case a couple months later or a month later, you know, I went, wow, I should try to write something with this tuning. And I did.
That's a great story about the guy in the cowboy hat and the yokes on his shirt. Because if you are too specialized in this industry, you won't get called back very much. Now he tells me about how he replaced some guitar parts for Eric Clapton in the movie Rush.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there was a movie called Rush, and it's not the movie about the Grand Prix thing. It's the one about starring Johnny Depp about cocaine and smuggling and stuff. And Eric Clapton had done the soundtrack, and they changed some stuff in the last reel of the movie. They reshot it. So they called up Clapton to go, you got to come to L.A. and rescore this part. And he goes, I can't. I have to be in Milan. And they go, well, you know, you have to. This movie's got a deadline and it's coming out and we got to get this finished. And he goes, I can't. I got to be in Milan. They go, well, what is it, a concert? And he goes, no, I have an appointment with my tailor. His appointment with like Versace or whatever. So he couldn't get out of that, right? So they call me. Somebody called me, and this lady actually from Universal or something, she goes, can you play in the style of Eric Clapton? And I go, what period? And so she goes, what do you mean? I go, well, there's the John Mayall period, then there's the Cream period, then there's the Delaney and Bonnie and the, you know, Eric Clapton right after that period. Then there's the Derek and the Dominoes period. Following that, there's the 80s period. And then, you know, I go on and on telling her of yeah, I can play on all these different, he's either using the SG, the Les Paul, the 335 in those early periods, and then he goes to the Strat, you know. Anyway, she basically said, no, it's the modern period. I go, of course I can do that. So I even have the soundtrack, of course, says, you know, guitar by Eric Clapton, but part of that movie is definitely me. I mean, when I first got married, my wife, we got this little apartment, and I've got my little music room, and she's getting ready to go off to work. And I'm in there playing, like, I'm practicing Camp Town Ladies, you know, and in the style of Chet Atkins, I'm working on Chet stuff. And she comes in and goes, oh, geez, that's the corniest stuff. What the heck are you doing? You know, she's thought she's married this artist with all this artistic integrity and everything. And here I am doing that, 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 that. She goes, that's the crap my dad listens to. That's cornball stuff. So believe it or not, she goes off to work. And about an hour later, the phone rings and it's this composer guy saying, hey, man, can you play in the style of Chet Atkins? And I go, yes, I am. Right now. And so I put the phone up to the guitar and played him something a little hipper than that. And he says, can you come down to the studio tomorrow and just bring a steel string acoustic? We're going to do the Albertsons supermarket theme in the style of Chet Atkins. We're going to do a 60-second and a 30-second. So he had it written like this. It's Joe Albertsons supermarket. And I said, well, I could do it like this. Right, in the style of Chet. So we did a 30 and a 60 and second version. And I went home and I was able to tell my wife, hey, man, you know, I got double scale because I'm the leader on the union session. When you're the only guy, you're the leader. What we didn't know, I didn't know at the time because I was only like about 29 years old or something, or maybe even less, is that they use that as a musical bed every time they change the copy. You get paid again. So this week it might be apples and lemons, and next week it might be chuck steak and tissues, you know, or bananas, you know. But whatever it was, every time they did a different voiceover in any region, meaning the Northwest, the Southwest, the Midwest, the South, the East, Northeast, Southeast, you know, I got paid again. Yeah, the union deal. So it would be, you know, this week at Albertsons. It would be a chuck steak and apples and oranges. Anyway, I never got paid less than $1,855 a month for 4.5 years. And so it was just this little bed of money that was coming in. And then sometimes it was more. Sometimes it would be like $2,400 a month. And I remember one day the guy called me and he goes, "Well, we finally lost the Albertsons account." And I go, "Well, it sure has been a good run." And then about a week after that, I got a call to play on an REO Speedwagon record. And this producer called me up and he goes, "Hey, man, we got to get this done. So we're just going to have you just ghost in some power chords and whatever." So I sent my cartage down to, it's called The Complex. I think it was owned by Earth, Wind & Fire at the time. It was a cool little studio. So I sent my gear down there, and about 3 hours later, this is still the day before, I get a call from this guy that I worked for a lot named Al Capps. And he was a jingle writer and a songwriter. He had written some songs for Cher and stuff like that. And so he says, "Hey, are you available for a jingle tomorrow morning?" And I go, "No, I'm too cool. You know, I got a record date with REO Speedwagon. Sorry, I'm just too cool for this." You know, I didn't say that, but I was thinking, "No, I'm busy. I got a session." So when we're just about to hang up, he goes, "Okay, I'll call you for the next one." I go, what am I missing?" And he goes, "Albertsons." And I go, "Just a second, man. Let me make some calls." So I called the REO guy and said, "Hey, can I come in at noon?" You know? And so anyway, I was able to do it. It was an orchestra date, meaning I was the principal soloist with a nylon string. And there was like, not a big orchestra, you know, it was like a little chamber group of about 15 string players and stuff. So the money got divided up a lot more. All those royalties have to go to 20 people, you know, not just me.
Oh, that's hilarious. I know it's great, those jingles like Albertsons, they pay really well. And also, it's very funny, I lived in L.A. for over 11 years, and I remember those particular commercials. Now Carl goes over his very impressive gear list and how many guitars he has.
I really love the Stratocaster more than anything. I can do more on that than anything else, especially the way I set up the Wang bar. So I have about 14 of those, three old ones, and then I have a signature model with a company called LSL. Those are really like the best of my, I took like the neck pickup off my 65 Strat and the bridge pickup off my 58 Strat, and I like the neck on my 61 Strat, and just all kinds of different combinations of things. And they make that guitar, and they sell quite a few of them, a few a month. They call it the CV Special. So those are, I take out on the road much more than I do the old ones, for sure. But I got a good example of everything, you know, a good 335 SG, a couple Les Pauls, a bunch of acoustics, Rickenbacker 12 string, Gretsch guitars, Dane Electro, Music Man baritone. And I have another baritone guitar that Alan Holdsworth gave me back in the day. But like I said, if it sounds good, keep it, you know, because you may not even use it all year, but then you'll need it. My own records, I think of modern guitar player records. You know, we've heard all the shredding stuff and all the chop stuff. And so what I like to hear and the records I like to make are just more orchestrated, more layered and orchestrated. And to do that, it's just great to have, you know, you say, okay, I'm going to have a basic stereo Strat clean rhythm sound with some stereo thing, whether it's harmonization or some chorus wiggle there. And then I'm going to put left and right acoustics on here at the second verse, so it kind of builds up. I'll play the left acoustic in standard open position, you know, down low, and then I'll capo halfway up the neck so I can get another thing going. And then when the chorus comes in, I'll add a crunchy Telecaster to just add a little bit of sonic girth to the chorus. And then if there's some sort of a line, you know, like double the bass line, I might use an SG and a Les Paul, but use little tiny amps so that the distortion doesn't overpower and it's just a nice stereo sound left and right. And then for the solo, that's where I'll mic an amp in a big room and put a microphone right on it, and then 10 feet back, put another mic. I have an engineer friend that likes to stand up on a stool, just walk around the rooms, get down on his knees until he hears where that amplifier is really blooming, where the sound really opens up, and put another mic there. Because you never really listen to guitar with your ear up to the speaker. You hear it in the room. So my philosophy about that is that, you know, one of these guitars is going to be what I call Frank Sinatra. You know what I mean? Like when you hear those old Frank Sinatra records recorded at Capitol, you know, this big band comes in and it's playing, swinging away, and it's really glorious. But then when Frank comes in, he's over the top of it all and even more wonderful, you know. So that's kind of the way I think of these kind of recordings, and more layered and orchestrated than just here's my rhythm guitar distorted track and here's my lead guitar more distorted track, you know. That gets old to me in a hurry. So I know. I mean, you listen to that Led Zeppelin stuff, and he was so brilliant at that. And that's partly because he was a studio guy, you know, and the amount of amazing studio tracks he played on before Led Zeppelin, like, you know, Donovan and Downtown by Petula Clark and all these things that were even pre-Beatles, you know, it's pretty amazing how much work he was doing. Another band that did that layering thing really well was the Eagles. Yeah, when you listen to a track like New Kid in Town, you know, it's just a simple little song, but all the great little guitar lines that come and go. And, you know, I mean, they had unlimited studio time, so that's part of it. What I end up doing is figuring it all out at home. Like, I'll take my band into the studio and just play a scratch guitar track and sing a scratch vocal and get the bass drums and even keyboards down. Then I'll bring it home here and I'll set up a bunch of amps out in the garage, and I'll just kind of go through, okay, for this chorus, I'm going to bring this pedal and I'm going to use that. And I'll write it down in a notebook so that when I get to my overdub day, I've got it pretty well figured out, at least first response, you know, first idea. And if that doesn't work, maybe even a second idea. But, you know, I kind of work it all out so I can go in the studio and knock out a tune a day without, you know, spending weeks and weeks of money.
Now, that's sound advice from a studio cat with the experience of Carl. Number one, bands or musicians or artists should know their stuff inside out before they even go into the studio to save money. Now, here's Carl Verheyen with Taylor's Blues. We'll be right back.
Brian here, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT, the best instrumental music on the Florida Space Coast.